History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and be patient enough to listen. Usually, we're talking to World War II veterans who were serving 8 decades ago, but this week, it's a 21st century edition with men who are currently serving in our armed forces and who earned the Distinguished Flying Cross for efforts not overseas, but in the wildfire smoke-saturated skies over California. Our goal is always the same, to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we're both educated and entertained. And so often, we're inspired when we hear firsthand accounts of the kinds of situations the vast majority of us will never find ourselves in. 3 years ago, in Sacramento, California, the President of the United States shared these remarks.
Today, it's my profound honor to award 7 extraordinary soldiers with the Distinguished Flying Cross for their remarkable courage to rescue their fellow citizens. Welcome to Chief Warrant Officers Joseph Rosamond, Kip Godding, Irvin Hernandez, Brady Labine, G. Jung, and Sergeants George Escoval and Cameron Powell. Thank you very much, and I will say that it's such an honor to be in your presence. You'll hear a story shortly that was very inspiring to me and to everybody else, and that's why these are very important medals. Just over 1 week ago, these brave pilots and crew members of the California Army National Guard embarked on a harrowing mission. As the sun set on September 5th, they boarded 2 helicopters that are behind me. Then they flew into blazing flames, raging wind, and it was raging, and blinding smoke to rescue families who were trapped by the massive creek fire at the Mammoth Pool campground. While they were on their way to the campground, the crew received word from state and local officials and headquarters that it was far too dangerous to continue the mission, turn back. But they decided to continue anyway, knowing they might not return. They knew that people were in danger, great danger. As night set in, they could see almost nothing through the miles of dense smoke. Using their night goggles and their expert navigation skill, they reached the camp. They found the stranded families, many of whom were badly burned and injured, and they loaded them, as many as they could, onto the 2 helicopters. Then they made the perilous flight back to the base. As soon as they unloaded the passengers, they again risked their lives and flew back into the blazing fire to rescue more victims. Their superior said, "You cannot do this. You cannot do it again." They did it. The smoke had become even more overpowering, yet they returned a third time. After 10 grueling hours, they completed their mission, having saved the lives of an astounding 242 people. We are proud of them.
There's a lot to be proud of, and today we get to meet them, 3 of those 7 members of the California National Guard who were awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. We'll also hear from one of the people they rescued in the wake of a reunion 3 years in the making that just took place this month at a Fresno State Bulldog football game. Let's begin with G. Jung, at the time a flight engineer, but now a Black Hawk helicopter pilot with the 1106th TASM-G, covering the entire western United States from its base in Fresno, California.
I'm from Fresno. I was actually born in Thailand, but my family immigrated here in 88. And so we were imported here from San Francisco, and this is where I grew up in Fresno my whole life.
And what made you want to join the service?
So I joined the service out of high school, you know, like most high schoolers. I didn't know what I wanted to do for my career, and the military seemed like a great thing to do at the time, and I joined. And while I served over the course of 18 years, you know, I really developed appreciation and patriotism, being able to help out the communities that I live with. And that really makes me proud and happy that I'm able to help people out.
And what do you remember about September 2020, flying into that scene? Can you describe what it look like and what you were seeing, feeling, experiencing?
Yeah, so what really resonated with me that night, I think the best way I can describe it is kind of like a scene in Dante's Inferno, you know, the gates of hell almost, where we put down our goggles and all you could see was flames and smoke. That's the best way I can describe it. Visibility was about a quarter mile, more or less in certain areas. But the fire actually really helped us out, you know, help us navigate the terrain because it really lit up. That's how we were able to get to the families and help them out.
Were there any moments in that long night where you wondered if you guys were going to be able to really do what you were trying to do?
Rescue missions, I've done all kinds of different missions, but every time we do a mission, risk mitigation always a big factor, you know. Is this going to endanger the crew? But we always do our best we can to try to help people out, and if it's worth it and we think we can do it, we're going to take the risk and go up there and get people out.
And, you know, you just said you've done all kinds of missions, and maybe you can give us some perspective on how this compares to other things you've done. Like, you've been in 18 years, you've been deployed overseas, I'm guessing?
Yes, that's correct. Been in 18 years, been deployed. It's a different kind of feeling, deployment versus, stateside. But stateside, you know, we do SAR missions. We do a lot of firefighting with CAL FIRE, and that really brings in the experience, being able to, you know, go out there and help fight fires. And that brings in comfortability for us when we attempted to go in and rescue the folks that were trapped. Having that experience from CAL FIRE, navigating the terrain and the smoke, and all that experience really combined to help us. Deployments are experiences a little bit different. I mean, you have people shooting at you, but here in the States, the mission set is different. Actually, the experience I've gained from CAL FIRE, fighting fires with the department, definitely helped us as a crew completely, contributed to the success of this mission here. The skills, the strategies, the techniques, what to look for, definitely contributed to the success of this search and rescue mission.
The last 3 years, have you ever wondered what happened to those people?
Yeah, I definitely do. What really resonates with me is are the children. I have kids myself, and I always wonder, you know, how they're doing. And I'm actually happy to see some of them. They're a lot bigger, and even some of the adults have gone to have their own children. And I'm really happy. I'm glad we were able to make an impact and help these families out, and so they can have a future.
Is there something that one of them said to you that really made an impression on you?
It got really emotional with one of the survivors. You know, he came up to me and he said, "Yeah, I remember you," and I'm happy and so thankful that you're able to help us out, and I have my own family now, and that really. That really sticks with me because, you know, I have my own family too, and if I was in the same situation, I'd be just as grateful. That really makes me happy that I'm able to help somebody out.
I didn't ask you this. What did it feel like to have the President of the United States give you the Distinguished Flying Cross personally?
You know what? Even till today, it feels unreal, you know, surreal. When I heard about it, you know, I was like, no, it can't be, you know. But, you know, there I was standing next to the President of the United States and shaking his hand, receiving the Distinguished Flying Cross. And I'm really glad. That's a great opportunity, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity in my life. I don't think I'll ever meet the President again, but who knows?
You never know. Yeah. You're still serving. And the Creek Fire experience, that rescue, is that part of what made you want to become a pilot?
I was already in the process of starting my packet. I'd already gone to walk school. And so I actually came back as an officer, warrant officer, and I was just on a little mini break before I started my pilot training. And so it happens that I got the call in between that time frame. I was an actual technician, so still I could perform my duties, and I, you know, answered the call and performed my duties, and I was able to help out people.
And if this one's not relevant, you know, tell me. But I'm just thinking, I've met a lot of Hmong veterans from the secret war in Laos, whose service has never really been recognized by our country. They don't get veteran status, yet they risk their lives the same way Americans did. Knowing that the generation before you was dealing with that, to get that DFC from the president, did that give it some context? Do you notice that contrast?
Yes, definitely made a great impact in the community. I just want to kind of go back to a story. My wife's grandpa was a soldier in the Secret War, and his job was actually to go out there and rescue downed American pilots in very dangerous situations. Being a second, third generation myself, the community really showed a lot of support, and I think it inspired a lot of young folks to join the military and do the same for the country.
Well, let's end there. If there's a young person, you know, maybe getting ready to finish high school, and someone said, hey, you ought to join the military. You can maybe even serve in your hometown with the 1106 TASMG. What advice would you give them?
You know, joining the military brings many opportunities, you know, especially coming from a background of poverty. You know, it opens a lot of doors. You know, education, the military definitely opens a lot of avenues for you to become successful and build those necessary skills to become successful in life. So I definitely recommend it, and, you know, go to school.
Again, that was Ji Zhang, one of the men awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for their role in rescuing more than 250 people during a wildfire in Central California 3 years ago. Time to meet another one, Irvin Hernandez, who grew up in a farming family in Parlier, California, and joined the National Guard after high school.
I joined as a 15 Papaw Flight Operations Specialist. I did that for a couple months. Didn't really vibe with me. I wanted to do a little bit more, and I was able to reclass as a 15 Golf, which is a sheet metal mechanic, so working on all the airframes, doing all the structural job of that. And after being here for 2 or 3 years around the aircraft, the idea is like, why don't I fly them? I enjoy them. It wasn't something my younger self would have realized that I could possibly do, but being in the Guard brought that opportunity to me. So I pursued it.
And I'm just guessing that's not all that common, that trajectory to come in at the bottom of the totem pole and make it up into that cockpit.
No, it's actually a pretty strenuous path to get there. A lot of people don't know that you can move that way. Similar to me, maybe it's not even in like an idea that crosses their mind. And for the general population, going from high school or off the streets, they aren't aware of the avenues to get to that position.
And have they sent you overseas?
Yes, I deployed in 2016 as a sheet metal mechanic. Went over there, I was in Kuwait, and I spent a little bit of time in Afghanistan. I had a great time, considering all. I had a great group of people that went, and which made that experience a lot more bearable.
What was the hardest part of that? Because most of us never experienced that. We're so used to this constantly connected world where we have our phone and we can text and call and see anybody anytime. What was the most challenging element of your being on the other side of the world?
Just being away from family and friends and knowing that their lives are kind of going on and you're kind of over there. Everything's still a bit of a standstill for you. So that was the hardest thing. But again, the people that I went with, I made a lot of lifetime friends. I learned a lot while I was there, and that was really what made it a good deployment for myself.
Were you ever in situations there where you felt you were in danger?
Well, when I was in Afghanistan, there's actually a bombing on the base. I remember the base was shut down. It was a little chaotic before we were able to secure the base and get a hold of everybody because the communications were down. So, yeah, that was one of the highlights of that deployment.
Highlights or boy, I don't want that to ever happen again.
Yeah, I don't want that to happen again. Definitely a memorable thing, and give that to somebody. Just you think you might go to Kuwait, but you can go to, which is not like a combat zone, but from that place you can be sent to other areas that are, specifically the unit we deployed with, the 1106 TASMG. We had a lot of teams that would go out to different areas to help with maintenance. That is a possibility, and you got to be aware of that before you sign up and be aware of that when you deploy.
And what's it feel like to fly one of those things?
One of the best feelings I've ever had. Every time I go fly, whether it's been a stressful day or whether I have, when I go fly, everything kind of just melts away. I'm enjoying it. The views are amazing every day. When we shut down, you kind of take a step back and like, wow, this is what I'm getting paid to do.
So how long had you been a pilot when this Creek Fire situation arose?
I had been a pilot a little over a year. So it was a relatively new pilot, definitely. One for the books, very learned a lot from there, from Mr. Godding. He's a very experienced pilot. I had actually just come off of a different mission. I had just arrived that Friday, and that Saturday morning, I looked down at my phone, saw the text, and before I finished reading the text, I'm already walking in trying to get my clothes. I was living in Merced at the time, so I had a little bit of ways to even get to Fresno. I responded and said, I'll be there as soon as I can, but if somebody can get there prior to me, then they can go. We got here, we were set up for the aircraft, and then things just started coming in, like this information, we're getting grid points, and like, this is happening. At first, we weren't aware of the amount of people. So we were told there are some people, there's no specific number, They're in New Mexico's reservoir. Didn't exactly know what to expect. I've been on fires before. I know it can be a very treacherous situation with the smoke, and the winds can change any time. So with my limited experience, I try to fall back on that.
Did you think this was something you guys could actually pull off, that you could get in there and get all those people out?
Yes, as the day progressed and as we got closer and closer, I thought, yes, we can do it. We stress safety, and we also train a lot to be prepared for many different situations. In the aircraft, things can change immediately, and so we train for those type of situations. Once we got in there, and then going back with me relying on the experience of my Mr. Godding, we talked it out with as a crew. Are we comfortable? Can we continue? I was comfortable continuing on as the way we briefed little by little, and I thought we could be successful.
But you'd never flown in those kind of conditions before, right?
No, that is not a typical situation that we will be flying in. The most we typically do during the day, there is smoke around. We typically stay away from the smoke. Although we can still smell it, there's still some smoke that gets in. But in that specific situation, no, that's not typical. Well, my motivation was during when I heard there's people, what's the community? These are people that we will may or may not see, or we may know who they are. And there's families that, it could have been my family down there. And that's what I thought. Is like, I would, even if I didn't go personally, if my extended family, I would want to see them safely return, knowing that there's people that need help. And we're literally the last line. That was my motivation.
And we all know that your goal was to save their lives, but I think you guys are probably the only ones that really know how much you risked your own lives, because that's what you were doing, right? I mean, you were putting all of your lives on those helicopters at risk by going in those conditions, weren't you?
Yes, but that actually comes with the territory being an Army aviator. We know when we enlisted and we decided to go pursue this path, deployments were going to happen. We're going to risk our lives. The job is inherently dangerous, as is just flying in a normal, beautiful, clear sky day. With that in mind, it's just another day risking our lives. Not to the extent of this, but we were prepared for that.
It's time for our first break, but when this special edition of Hometown Heroes continues, that daring rescue through the eyes of both rescuer and rescuee. Go to hometownheroesradio.com for photos related to this incredible story, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties, and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a focus today on a daring rescue 3 years ago during wildfire season in California that had the commander-in-chief flying out within a week to decorate 7 courageous men with the Distinguished Flying Cross. We'll get back to some of the rescuers' perspectives in a moment, but first let's hear from one of the more than 250 people rescued that night. Alex Tetamonte had been enjoying the majestic scenery of the Sierra Nevada mountains with friends and family when the quickly spreading Creek Fire turned her birthday celebration and an annual tradition into an apocalyptic nightmare in September 2020.
I made the 911 call, and I let them know, like, we have a lot of kids with us, a lot of families with us. We're stopped trying to get to the lake. You know, there's trees that have fallen down that have barricaded us between the campsite and the lake. And the 911 operator just kept saying, like, get to the water, get to the water. The car in front of us was able to, we have big, big off-roading trucks with big grills and stuff like that. It rammed into this tree that had fallen a couple times back and forth. And the tree finally, like, broke open and we were able to drive through it. Well, on the way to the lake, while there's people running by our car, once we're able to start moving, me and my husband tell people, get in the car, like, get in our truck, get in the back. There's one point during my 911 call, she asks how many people I had in the vehicle. And I had crawled up onto the center console sitting closest to my husband so that people could get in the passenger side. Our whole back was filled. We had people on laps, on laps, on laps. My dog was back there somewhere, probably on somebody's lap or somebody was sitting on his lap. But I think I counted 15 to or 17, something like that, people in the truck of my, in the bed, in the cab of my truck.
Wow.
And I know there was another five or six. I know there was two people in the dog kennel, I heard, that we have a Mastiff. So we have a very large dog kennel, and two guys had crawled into the dog kennel in order to be able to fit more people into the bed of our truck also. So we don't even know how many people. We had people hanging on to the doors, like from the outside of the vehicle. We just had as many people as we could once we were able to start moving. We were trying not to leave anybody behind. Of course, as soon as we got down to the lake, it's kind of like that deep breath, like, okay, well, at least we're near the water. At least there's no trees going to fall on us. That was the scariest part while we were driving, is I was afraid a tree that was on flames. We had fire not even 10 feet from both sides of the car as we were driving to the lake, and trees falling. So I was really afraid we were going to get stuck there, a tree fall on us, something. So as we got to the lake, that's kind of like the first sigh of relief, like, okay, well, we're not going to get trapped right there. And I started thinking, like, okay, we have to be smart with how much food we have, how much water we have, because we're going to be up here for a while. It's going to take a while for them to get to us. So we started, you know, walking around, checking on people, making sure that our entire group was there and safe, you know, helping out other people in other groups. It was daylight when we got there. And then it was quite a few hours of daylight. And then, you know, it got dark. And it wasn't until after it was dark for a while that the helicopters got there. So I would say they probably got there about 9, 10 o'clock. And that was just, you know, the first helicopter. It's crazy. When we heard the propellers, is that what they're called?
The rotors.
The noise of the helicopters in the distance. It was like, do you hear that or am I going crazy? And then my husband was like, no, I hear that. I was like, is that a helicopter? And he's like, yeah, they're probably just coming to see, like, where we're at. Or they're probably coming to drop us water and food or something. But never in a million years did we think that helicopter was going to land and take us out of there. So that was pretty crazy when it started getting lower and lower. We were like, oh, my God, it's coming. We heard the rotors from the helicopter and saw the lights from it. Everybody started cheering and screaming. People were honking their horns. We had flashlights, cell phones, car lights, everything. Everybody was trying to, like, flash and wave so the helicopters could see that there's people down here. So once the helicopters landed, I ran up to one of the helicopters and I let them know as best I could. It was really, really loud next to a military helicopter. But I let them know as best I could, like, we have a trailer full of people that have burns, injuries, broken bones. Like, we have people that need to go right now, like, as fast as they can to the nearest hospital. One of the guys asked me, like, how many people are here? And I'm trying to show him with my hands, like, 300. And so I do, like, 30. And after I did 30, he, like, gave me a thumbs up. And I was like, no, not 30, like, 300. 300. And I kept saying, like, I don't know if he understood me. I don't know if he understood me. I mean, obviously they figured out there was a lot of people there, but we did have the people that needed medical attention get out quickly on the first helicopter. And then the women with the smallest babies, a 7-month-old, a 9-month-old, and there was a couple other pretty small babies there. We had them on the Black Hawk, which was a little bit smaller. And then I was on the next round of helicopters, the helicopter that was packed to the brim. Me and my husband and our dog were on that helicopter. Funny little side note is we weren't sure that they were allowing the dogs to come on the helicopter. We didn't know if they were like, no, humans only. And so, you know, that puppy was like my little baby at the time. We wrapped him up in a blanket and pretended like he was a little baby and we were holding him. But he's not, even at 9 months old, he was about 40, 45 pounds. So he was a big, heavy baby holding him. later we found out, of course, like anything with a pulse was allowed to get on the helicopter. But me and my husband were some of the last people to board on that helicopter. They couldn't get the ramp up in the back. I felt like it was like a 2-inch toe strap across the back. And me and my husband were like against the tow strap, looking over the edge of the helicopter as it's taking off. And it was like, okay, we survived a fire, but are we going to survive this helicopter ride? Looking back on it now that like, I'm like, okay, we're safe. It was actually pretty cool. We could look down and, well, morbidly cool, maybe, could look down and see the fire. I mean, it was nighttime, so you could just see everything glowing. I'm sure the pilots were stressed and white knuckling it, but so were we in the back holding the dog against the tow strap. And there was a mom next to me that was holding her kid, not a baby, but like maybe like a 5 or 6-year-old kid. So pretty big. And she was holding her and I was holding the mom and my husband was holding the dog and we were all holding on to each other just because that back of that plane was pretty, I mean, one little movement and, you know, it's like a wave. Everybody moves. So that was pretty crazy.
Boy, I can't even imagine. And that's a real powerful description of it. And since then, in the 3 years since, I know you've learned a lot about what those pilots and their crews were dealing with and that there were some who thought it was too risky for them to come in and get you. What's the most amazing part of all of it to you with everything you know now?
With everything I know now, first that the pilots were willing to risk their lives for people they don't know, people they've never met. That's like, you got to be a good human to be able to put that aside. And I mean, they have their own lives, their own families. And the fact that they would risk all of that for us. Oh, I did not expect that. Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
There are so many reasons the emotions are still so powerful 3 years later. We'll hear more from Alex Tedamonte before we're done. But back to one of the rescuers now, Irvin Hernandez, in the cockpit of a Black Hawk helicopter through the smoke and the flames. Irvin, are there some moments from that 17-hour marathon of this risky rescue that stand out to you?
Yes, there's actually three moments that I remember every time the Creek Fire comes back up. The initial arrival, the first iteration that we popped popping out of the smoke into the reservoir, very apocalyptic, fire, embers all around, people in the water, vehicles there, and then landing, knowing when the crew chief got out, realizing these people are panicking, and for my crew chief to go down there and be able to rally them and corral them away from our tail rotor, which is a dangerous area to come up on, if you don't know. And then just seeing those people coming in, people that are limping, people that are asphyxiating because of the smoke, women and children. I remember seeing an infant on, I believe, the second iteration. We landed here. I looked back, and there was a mother sitting there with her child, no more than like a year old at most. And just seeing the gratification in her eyes and knowing that I have my own children, that really sat with me.
And just you telling that story makes me wonder how often over these last three years you've thought about those people that were on your Black Hawk that are alive today because your crew went in and got them. How often do you think about them?
Constantly, actually. Every time there's somebody brings it up from the Creek Fire or whenever we're flying around, because that is our local area. We fly in those mountains constantly. So every time we go up there, we see the scorch that was left, and it brings back those memories.
Well, I got to ask you about the president. This is not a political appearance. This is the commander-in-chief coming to honor you guys for risking your lives to save 264 of your fellow citizens. What was that day like for you?
It was surreal. And I kind of still don't believe that that happened to me. I'm just a guy that came out of Parlier, a small town, working in the fields growing up, and being able to be in that position, very surreal, I'm very honored. A bit of me was like, this is my job, but to be recognized for me just doing what I'm supposed to be doing, don't really know whether I deserve it or not. Again, I'm just doing my job to be recognized for just doing my job. That's what I signed up for. That's what I decided to become a pilot, to help people, to help my country. But at the end of the day, I'm very honored that happened. The whole event just was great, very memorable for myself, for my family. They were very proud of me for being in that situation. Just an honor to be in front of the president and just be in the presence of the president. Kind of overwhelming, but very rewarding as well.
If you have to dress up and you wear your uniform with that Distinguished Flying Cross on it, what comes to mind when you see that, when you put that in place on your uniform?
Pride. Pride in the part that I played in it, and knowing that there's families that were affected that led me to get that. It doesn't represent, for me, not so much the award itself, but it represents all the families that are still here because of that. Something to me that I've always wanted to recognize, all the people that weren't recognized with us as a crews. There was a lot of people on the ground that were helping us, making us successful. For example, our flight operations that came in to help us, they were the ones calling the fire department, the ambulances, the medevacs and all that, coordinating cots and all that, helping the people as we offloaded them, situating them and rallying them up. Those people were a big driving factor. It wasn't just us picking them up, but the people on the ground that were doing all the additional legwork.
In the podcast edition of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com, you can hear some bonus material from one of those people on the ground, then Colonel, now General, David Hall, who had the courage to greenlight this daring rescue mission when others might not have. And when we come back, the most experienced helicopter pilot participating that night puts it all in perspective for us. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a different twist today with some much younger voices, men who earned their Distinguished Flying Crosses, not in Europe or the Pacific, not in Korea, Vietnam, or even Iraq or Afghanistan, but amidst smoke and flame consuming a good portion of the Sierra Nevada foothills during California's Creek Fire in 2020. They rescued more than 250 people from the Mammoth Pool Reservoir. The most experienced Black Hawk pilot participating that night was San Pedro, California native Kip Godding.
I've been in the military for about 37 years, and I've been flying for 26 of those years. Serving in the military is a great honor. As cheesy as that sounds, it's a fantastic privilege to be able to do it, and then to be able to do a job as far as a pilot job in that pursuit as well is just fantastic. It's a definite honor, and feel very lucky to be able to do it for this long.
Yeah, and in all those years, I'm sure that birds like this Black Hawk that we're leaning on right now have taking you a lot of different places. Can you give us a taste of some of the places you've been?
Military's everywhere, and so people are out there supporting us and protecting us. So certainly all the countries in the Middle East. Been privileged to go to Central America, been to Greenland, the Far East, Korea and Japan and Okinawa. Just about every sector of the world we've been there.
And we're going to be talking about September of 2020 and what happened during the Creek Fire, but I'm just guessing in all your years of service before then, you probably have had a hairy moment or two in the skies.
Yeah, it's not a very forgiving business, so there's definitely times where your hair on the back of your neck standing up, certainly all the combat situations, and then every year here in California we have year after year breaking records for the fire season. So we have some significant challenges trying to keep up with that. So yeah, some real heavy duty attention gathering flights.
Can you give us a taste maybe of one of those scenarios in combat or elsewhere where, as you said, the hair was standing up on the back of your neck?
Yeah, well, luckily here in California, we have a long history of working with Cal Fire, and we have an excellent training program. And every year we reorient ourselves to the coming summer and coming fires. So we have a great collaborative program with those guys, working together, sharing experiences. Obviously they have a huge knowledge base of how to fight fires, and then we have, as the state, we have a lot of Blackhawks here that we can employ to do that, to help with that. So every year is tough. I mean, this one got a lot of attention because of all the square footage, all the acres, almost 400,000 acres that were burnt, and then the structures, I think probably close to 900 structures were destroyed. But we're doing that every year. Every year we're out there fighting fires, whether they're 300 acres or 300,000 acres. So all of them are challenging. All of them are hard. Take your full focus, full attention.
And how about a combat scenario, just so we understand maybe some of the things that you guys go through? What would be a situation you found yourself in where, you know, lives are at stake, including your own?
Yeah, certainly ground fire and controlled flight into terrain. CFIT is our greatest risk of the situation, the crew getting disoriented or not knowing where obstacles are or where the terrain is. So the night vision goggles obviously assist in that greatly, using the illumination that's available and magnifying it so that you can see in the dark, so that you don't fly into the tower, the wires, or the ground, and you can devote your full attention to not flying into the enemy areas or evading their, you know, ground fire or whatever it is that they're trying to shoot you down with.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but most of us haven't done this, right? Most of us has never piloted a helicopter, certainly not in high-risk situations like you have. Have there been days where you weren't sure that you were going to land that bird, that you were going to make it back and see your family?
You don't really think about that at the time. And even during this rescue, the thought never came in my mind. We were just focused on what we had to do. And then when you get back and you're decompressing, maybe at home or whatever, yeah, those thoughts are just as overwhelming as anybody else when you get completed that stressful situation, and could certainly, you know, be a little debilitating, but not at the time. At the time, we were definitely focused on how we can accomplish it and how we can accomplish it, you know, safely, and that's what you're focused on.
I mean, it just, you kind of make it sound like it's no big deal and it doesn't rattle you at all.
Again, it's a big deal when you get back and you think about it, but it's not a big deal. Certainly having done flying this aircraft that we're sitting on for 26 years, just like sometimes you don't think about something in your car because you're used to it and comfortable with it. And that's the same as it is for me in this. Just a matter of fact and completing it and trying to do it safely and help the guys that are less experienced learn and move on to the next mission. Normally when we are doing firefighting activities, we are staying on the outside of the fire. We're working the perimeter of the fire, trying to keep it from destroying structures or getting into more dangerous areas, or try to guide it to where the firefighters feel they have a better defensive area. So we're staying on the outside of the fire. But here at the Creek Fire, those, you know, civilians, they were stranded inside the fire. So flying for 30 minutes over burning terrain was certainly the first time I'd done it. And that is, you know, difficult mindset. You have no place to put the aircraft down if you had a mechanical problem or you had some sort of issue. It's either continue to where you're going to pick up these people that need to be rescued or continue all the way back to where you came from. There's no in between because it's all on fire. So that's high up there.
So you've flown in situations where there's ground fire, there could be RPGs, there could be missiles, rockets, whatever, and you're telling me this fire was just as dangerous or just as threatening to your mission?
Absolutely, because those other events, you're not seeing it in front of you. It is somebody that's watching you, and as you get closer, they might try to engage you, and you may or may not know about it at the second that it's happening, but there's no anticipation, there's no buildup. We're here, you can see the fire in front of you, and you know that's where you're going, and you're going deep into it for 30 minutes, and it's going to be another hour before you're back out of it, and then to do it again and again. So that was a little bit different type of stress. You had to confront it head on and keep going, as opposed to the ground fire or whatnot, the engagements of the enemy, which happens very, very instantaneously. And you're either continuing to flying or you're finding a place to put the aircraft down because it's damaged. Cal Fire already had an aircraft over the fire, working the fire. He was unaware that there were people trapped inside of it. He is a firefighter. He was working the fire, and he was reluctant to let us cross his fire line because he was trying to put out the fire, and it took a lot of coordination and a lot of insistence on our part that we wanted to go beyond, and they didn't know what our mission was, and so they were doing their job, we were trying to do our job. So initially, yeah, they said, no, we're not going to let you pass the fire line, we're not going to let you continue. And then it got dark, and they don't have night vision goggles, and we have night vision goggles. And once it became evident that they were going to have to leave the fire, they could not continue to firefight after dark, we took over with our goggles, and we were able to get permission to cross the fire line and head on into Mammoth Pools to get those guys. But we just kept at it as best we could. Sometimes the valley or the water drainage that we used the previous turn was closed down. It was completely socked in with smoke, so we had to backtrack and go around a different way. The area that the fire was at is our training area, so here it's just up the hill from the Fresno airport, so we know most of the valleys and could successfully pick an alternate route. And then the third time, that first route was closed down, the second route was closed down, we picked a third route and just kept peeking up each valley until we found one that was enough visibility to get back to the Mammoth Pools.
How close do you think you came to one of those moments where you guys said, no, this is it, we can't do this?
We did have at least one of those issues, because when the first ingress, we were coming up the San Joaquin River drainage, and even though we were flying extremely close to each other, it just got too much smoke, and we lost sight of the aircraft in front of us, so we immediately stopped, let them continue and get some separation. Then we turned back around and found another route. So that time it did elevate to the top of, hey, this is unsafe, We can't continue. We've got to figure out a different plan of attack. And then there were other times going over. We had to go all the way up over Shaver Lake and over Kaiser Pass to get in through the backside. And there was a couple times that we would, again, go up a valley and get close to the top where we thought we were almost there, and we had to stop and turn around because of the smoke or the fire or whatever was precluding us from being able to continue up that valley.
Again, trying to put myself in your shoes, and I hear stories like that, and the phrase that comes to mind is flying blind. I know you have instruments. I know you have the terrain reading technology. But how hard is that to fly in those conditions when visibility is just nothing?
It is very difficult. It takes a lot of experience. Luckily, with multiple tours to the Middle East has lots of habus where the wind brings the light sand off the surface and the visibility gets to, you know, half a mile or less. So experience in encountering that previously, being able to slow down and not overfly your visibility. So all that experience is what helps. Obviously, the least amount of experience, you're going to reach your limit sooner, and you're going to have to turn around. Luckily, we had a very experienced crew in both aircraft, and we were able to get right down to the maximum allowable to be able to continue.
Those people you brought back, do you have memories of some of the looks on their faces, your feel for what they were going through?
I do. When we first came onto the boat launch, the very first turn, it was pandemonium there on the beach. A lot of people, I'm sure, very nervous and scared people, and a lot of people in board shorts and just were hanging out for a nice afternoon, and all of a sudden they're in this critical situation.
As we hear a Chinook fire up its engines, I guess that's what they heard when some of these were leaving that night. What was motivating you during those moments, during that process, you know, three times and the whole night? What was driving you?
The motivation and drive during that mission was I knew that as a crew and as a flight of two aircraft that we had the ability to do it, that we could sneak through at the tightest of margins, and we had the experience and the fantastic aircraft to be able to get in there, get those people out, and nobody else was coming. So they were going to have to spend the night, and depending on winds and vegetation, where the flames are going to go, they were definitely going to have a long scary night if we didn't get in there to get them all out. And people were injured as well, burns and breaks. They were going to have to suffer through many hours before somebody was able to get to them the next day. So that was the motivation to keep going. We can do it, and let's keep going till we can't.
So correct me if I'm wrong. If I make a statement that you don't think is completely accurate, set me straight. So I'm just sharing my understanding of the situation. You were trying to do something that you'd never done before.
Correct. That was new territory to fly that deep into the black, into the burn area.
And you were doing something that a lot of people would say you probably shouldn't do. There's no guarantee you're going to get out of there alive or get those people out of there alive.
Possible people had opinions, but we were there on scene. We could see what the obstacles were, and we knew our abilities. We knew that we could. So we just worked hard to convince those people that weren't there, firsthand knowledge and firsthand sight, that we had the ability to do it and we could continue to do it safely.
How much satisfaction did you have knowing how many lives had been saved?
Yeah, it's a huge honor that we were there and had the ability and the training and experience to be able to accomplish it. It's definitely one for the books and one for the career.
When you see photos from Mammoth Pool or video of the flames and the people that you're rescuing, what does that trigger for you?
Triggers the just incredible apocalyptic scene that we were at when flying over there. And, you know, like we discussed before, going overseas in combat, you know, a little bit experienced and not numb, but certainly been in situations like that before. But thinking of the civilians down there who, again, were just up there for a day of boogie board and you know, skiing, and all of a sudden they're in the fight for, you know, their and their children's lives. So those pictures are pretty just awe-inspiring, of just the whole frame, left to right, top to bottom. Everything that can burn is burning.
And it's fairly rare for a Distinguished Flying Cross to be earned over American soil. There's been a lot of them, you know, handed out in World War II and Korea and Vietnam and the Middle East. But to get that in your backyard, is a unique distinction. And to have the President of the United States fly all the way across the country to pin it on your chest, most distinguished flying crosses don't end up on someone's uniform that way. So what was that moment like to have the President do that for you?
It was definitely surreal to see things on TV and people and organizations and whatnot, and then all that to show up here for you and your crew is pretty impressive. It was a fantastic honor.
Distinguished Flying Cross recipient Kip Godding, one of seven honored for their heroics 3 years ago in that daring rescue during California's Creek Fire. Back to one of those rescued now, Alex Tedamonte, for a final word.
3 years after you survive all of this and you experience something that, Lord willing, most of us listening are never going to experience, you get to meet in a very different setting the men who, as you just said, risked their own lives to save yours. Can you help us understand what that moment was like, that reunion?
There's not even, like, words to tell, like, express, like, the gratitude and the thankfulness. Like, it was, I don't want to say surreal. That's not quite the right word, but it was like, I don't even know how to tell you how I feel. I mean, you could only say, like, thank you, and I appreciate you, and I'm grateful for you, and all those things, but I don't think it really, it doesn't, like, quite give the message that you feel inside. And what's crazy is the pilots were so humble and so, like, grateful that we were there. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. We're grateful for you. We think about you all the time.
And I guess now you have a daily reminder with another member of your family who wouldn't have been here without what they did.
Yes, absolutely. I have a new little baby. She's a terror sometimes, but she's definitely a blessing that maybe we wouldn't have had. And, you know, my puppy's grown up and he's 3 years old, almost 4 years old now. And he made it. My husband made it. I made it. And yeah, we're able to keep growing our family.
Well, thank you so much for helping us understand in such a powerful way what it was like to be there, to experience this, to be on the receiving end of the heroics that earned those rescuers the Distinguished Flying Cross. Is there anything else that you want to say about them, or that maybe you said to them when you got a chance to meet them?
I don't think anything else. I think I have said my thank yous as best as I can. I'm, you know, just trying to live every day, like, with that pay it forward mindset. You know, sometimes the best way to thank somebody is to just live your life with honor and integrity and, you know, doing the right thing.
Words of wisdom we can all take to heart as we reflect on the courageous example of Kip Godding, Irvin Hernandez, Ji Zhang, and everyone who contributed to that incredible rescue 3 years ago, not to mention the rest of the veterans we get to hear from each week on Hometown Heroes. If you pull up the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find additional material, including the views of General David Hall, who flew out from the Pentagon to be part of a special reunion between the rescuers and more than 80 of those they pulled out of the fire. We are out of time on the radio for today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
As promised, here is Brigadier General David Hall. Talking to the pilots, they're so humble about this. They make it sound like it was no big deal and just a routine mission. What's your perspective in the big picture of what they did that night and why it was so significant?
So I'll tell you, there were a lot of different aspects that made this, you know, probably the most significant search and rescue that we've ever done. When you think about a typical search and rescue, obviously, you don't have all the environmental issues that those crews had to deal with, you know, between the smoke, the fire, Fact that there were a lot of aircraft working to put the fire out, and then also having the uncertainty of what the conditions were like as they were going in for landing. Normally when we do a search and rescue, yes, it's high altitude, the terrain's a little bit rugged, it's windy, but you don't have the visibility concerns, you know, that you do with this particular mission. I think another aspect that is extremely important is the nature of this mission and the duration. They weren't postured to do this mission when they woke up in the morning. This was something they were going about their ordinary day and were told, hey, we need you to come in. We've got a big problem. And so they dropped what they were doing. They assembled the crews, the team, you know, took care of the aircraft, made sure that the aircraft were ready to go, and then launched into uncertain conditions. And those uncertain conditions, lasted well into the night. I think by the time we were done with the rescue, it was probably about 2 to 3 in the morning. And the compounding risk on that flight is the only extremely high risk mission I've ever approved in my career. And I've never seen an extremely high risk mission approved either. They talk about this being, you know, a routine mission for them. It's not quite routine. It's a little bit more than that. But what I will say is it was the right crews to do the job. And I think we were able to mitigate the risk effectively by the way that we managed the operation, that it was a success.
Well, and you mentioned that, the only extremely high-risk mission you've ever approved. It's clear it required courage for them to do this, and endurance and strength. And obviously, they're motivated by the chance to save these lives. But was there part of you, was there a by-the-book part of you that said, I can't approve this, it's too risky, it's too dangerous?
I will tell you, the first two missions were pretty easy to approve for us. You know, we had done the risk assessment, a lot of confidence in the crews. My biggest concern was that last mission in particular. The reason why so many people came out on that second lift was because the crews were not confident that they would be able to get in a third time. The smoke had deteriorated to where the visibility was approximately a half a mile. And what ends up happening at night typically is smoke continues to settle and the visibility gets worse and worse. And because of the duty day considerations and all the other factors that were out there, we spent quite a bit of time talking through the issues and what our emergency and backup plans would be in the event something went wrong to ensure that there wasn't an aircraft mishap.
I don't know if this is an easy one to answer, but when it comes to what they did that day, what was the most impressive element of it to you? What gave you the most pride in what they did?
You know, there were several aspects that I think were amazing. One was the judgment that Mr. Rosemond had when he said, hey, I'm going to take these individuals to Fresno. And when you think about that decision alone, that decision was extremely smart. Madera County is a small county. A lot of the hospitals are very rural. By coming to Fresno, it was an area where there were more resources that could come to deal with multiple injuries. We have trauma centers that are extremely close, and we have the infrastructure set up that can handle dealing with an influx of hundreds of individuals. So that was one aspect. The other aspect that I think is important is this idea of connecting to community. That was one of the things that, they talked about it, is they were preparing for the, you know, second and third flight. They knew that those were their friends up there. They were family members. They could have seen their kids up there. And so to them, the idea of pushing on in a cautious manner, but being deliberate about ensuring that they got every last person back, it was impressive to see. To a T, when we asked on that final mission whether or not they were willing to go in again, every single crew member said yes.
And last thing, you know,
Here it's a triple-digit day in Central California. These people who were rescued traveled to be here to meet those who rescued them, and you flew all the way from the Pentagon to be here. Why was that so important to you that you felt the need to be here?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons why it's important. Probably the most important is it's not often that somebody who is involved in the rescue actually gets a chance to break bread and talk with the individuals that were rescued and hear their perspectives. And I think that's an important motivator for why we do what we do. The other aspect of this, I think, is it's about inspiring service. You know, you think about a lot of the issues that are floating around, and I think that not everybody is interested in continuing to serve. And I think when you think about what the crews did, what the first responders did that were involved that night, whether it was, you know, firefighters, paramedics, law enforcement, the hospital personnel, the firefighters that were actually standing in the flames, right, you know, trying to stop the flames from overtaking towns. That is an important role that this country has. And this type of an event is something that I think showcases the importance and the need to serve.
I did think of one more real quick. You've been visiting with some of these people who were rescued. Is there something that one of them said to you, shared with you, that just really grabbed you, made an impression on you?
I will tell you the one that made the biggest impression was when I spoke with one of those that was rescued, and they were holding a daughter that was not born. And, you know, just to, you know, see that, you know, the happiness in her eyes, you know, she looked at, you know, her daughter, you know, with the whole mindset of that moment, she didn't know if she was going to make it out alive. And I think, you know, when you hear stories like that, it definitely, you know, makes you proud of what you do.